Welcome to the Hoops Hype Podcast. My name is Alex Kennedy. Joining me today is 13-year NBA veteran Larry Hughes, who averaged 14.1 points per game over the course of his career, which included stints with the Sixers, Warriors, Wizards, Cavs, Bulls, Knicks, Hornets, and Magic. Now he's enjoying retirement and running the Larry Hughes Basketball Academy. Larry, thanks for joining me. How are you?
I'm doing well. How you doing?
I'm doing great. As great as I can be at this time. Things are kind of crazy. How are you holding up during this whole mess?
I'm hanging in there, man. Just really taking it easy, taking time to, reorganize and re-strategize for when everything is active and we can get back to a normal life.
Yeah, that's smart. Got to be productive during this time. But I want to talk about your upbringing. We'll get into your NBA career, your off-court endeavors, all of that. Starting off, growing up in St. Louis, when did you start playing basketball?
I started playing schoolyard basketball. I mean, probably around fifth grade. That's when you had your pickup games, your 21 games, your bucket games. And then I got into organized basketball during my sixth grade year, which I was about 12 years old. So from there on is really the starting point of organized basketball, and I fell in love with the environment, the competition, and it was something that I was naturally good at. So I was able to kind of have a head start.
Was there a certain point when you realized that you were good enough to play college ball or potentially even play in the NBA?
No, I never really knew at each step if I was good enough to be successful at the next step. So playing youth basketball, I never translated that into if I'm going to be good in high school. I had a good high school career. I never really thought about, will I have a good college career? So I was just kind of in the moment at every step. And it really worked out for me that way because I didn't get too far ahead of myself.
For sure. If you hadn't played in the NBA, what career path do you think you would have went down? Were there any other interests or careers that you were considering?
Not necessarily. I knew I grew up in the city of St. Louis, so I knew I wanted to be successful. I knew I wanted to have some ownership. I knew I wanted to somewhat have a responsibility to wear a suit every now and then. So something that was along those lines of just being in the business environment, I think.
You were drafted by the Philadelphia 76ers. What was your draft night like, and what are some of your favorite memories from that evening?
Man, it was amazing. I had, a lot of my family there, which is, my draft year, we were actually in Vancouver, Canada. As far as, being in St. Louis and being in the Midwest, I got a chance to travel out to Canada, to Vancouver, all the way west, and bring my family along, my grandmother, my great uncles, my high school coach. So it was a big time for me.
And you played with Allen Iverson. I recently had Theo Ratliff on the podcast, and he raved about Iverson as a player and as a person. I know you two developed a pretty close relationship. What was it like playing with AI, and how was he off the court too?
He was, one of my good friends. This is one of my good friends. We played together for a short period of time. We've been friends way longer. We had a connection from day one with our family history. I had a little brother that was struggling from some medical issues, and he had a little sister that was struggling from some medical issues. So that was really our bonding point. And actually, my little brother, who's passed away since then, actually was the first person to meet him. He met him before I did. So we had a great connection, off the court first.
I'm so sorry about your brother. And I did read about that. When that kind of thing happens, how did that change your outlook on life or change things for you?
It's perspective. It makes you, live one day at a time. Nothing is promised. And you have to, like we're in the space today, in this day and age, you have to, love on your family members and be there for them, through tough times. So that's what it taught me, is to, really be, in the moment and really recognize, just the gifts that we have.
For sure. So in your second season, you averaged 22.7 points, 5.9 rebounds, 4.1 assists, 2 steals. I mean, you were just playing great after joining the Warriors. How much fun was that, and what did that do for your confidence?
It was huge for me. I came from a winning situation in Philadelphia. I wanted to play more. I wanted to explore. I've never been a guy that, didn't get a lot of minutes, so that was a little foreign to me at the time. But it was a gift and a curse, saying that is going to another team. It's not always greener on the other side. but it did give me a chance to explore my game, you know, understand what I could and couldn't do. You know, it gave me some roles and responsibilities that I took advantage of. So I understood that I could score the basketball in the league. And then it was just about, you know, being a winner, you know, finding out ways to become a winner.
You then went to the Washington Wizards. You played with Michael Jordan during his final season in the NBA in 2002-03. When Jared Jeffries was on the podcast, he said that it was like traveling with the Beatles, and he even saw people faint at times when they met Jordan. What were some of the craziest fan interactions that with MJ that you witnessed?
Well, there was two. Two for me, man, that really stands out as you asked that question is, one trip we were going to Chicago. We were playing the Bulls, and obviously MJ is the greatest thing since sliced bread in that city for the Bulls. So we were going to a nightclub to hang out, and M would always come and hang out with the team. He would always hang out, but he would just be there. So he would just appear. So he wouldn't necessarily go through the front door. Didn't know if he came through the back door, you know, didn't know if they had a secret entrance for him, but he would always be there. So we were kind of walking and we saw him coming in. And as we saw him coming in, you know, all the heads turned. We also had, you know, the camera phones were starting to become a big thing. So you would see all the phones come up, and now it's a picture. Everybody's taking pictures and video of him walking through. And Charles Oakley was with him. And it was one guy that would not respect the fact that M was trying to get to his seat. He would not move. So Charles Oakley, Alan Charles Oakley was a teammate. He was a coach, but he was more so MJ's enforcer. So he had some words with the fan. The guy literally got down on his knees and he gave the, you know, I don't know what you call it, but he waved his hands up and down as to, you know, MJ, you know, you are the king, you are the greatest. And he just got up and he moved out of the way. MJ sat down and I was just like, okay, I've never seen that happen, you know, real life. I've only seen that happen in the movies. So that was one time that stood out to me. And the other time we were out, I can't remember where we were at, but we were at an event where they had, you know, families and kids that were around. And we were doing some pictures and some autographs and things of that nature. And M would always, he had a cigar deal. He had a cigar deal. He would always have a cigar, whether it was lit or not lit. But I can remember this occasion, the cigar being lit. And this mom, she wanted her kid to take a picture with MJ. And she did not care that he had this stinky cigar, you know, lit, you know. She forced her kid into MJ's hand and basically forced a picture. And I don't know if this picture is still around or what, but there should be a picture around with MJ with a maybe, you know, 12 to 18 month old baby with MJ with a cigar in his hand. And I don't know if he's smiling or not, but that picture should be around. So those are two things that stand out to me throughout my time with MJ.
I love it. Not often you see another person worship someone, so that's pretty great.
Exactly.
At that point, you were 24 years old. How much did you learn from Jordan during that season?
I learned a lot, and a lot of it had to do with off the court situations, whether it was, you know, how he walked into our locker room before our games, how he would go in to get treatment, you know, at a certain time before our games, how he would address the media in a way that he, you know, just commanded their attention and commanded their respect, how he walked in and out of rooms. You know, the presence and the feeling that you got when he walked into a room and when he left out of a room. So I was more, and I'm naturally like that. I'm more of a thinker and more of a watcher. So those are the things that I remember most about MJ as his off the court, his persona, his, you know, the things that he carried around with him that, you know, that were really glorified.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories, you know, about how he was kind of difficult to play with and how, especially in Washington, he was really hard on the young guys. There's been stories about Kwame Brown and things like that. And I actually talked to Kwame a few years ago, and he said, you know, some of those things are blown out of proportion, but there was this reputation for being hard on guys. What was he like as a teammate, and was he really hard on you as one of the younger guys?
No, we were good. I didn't have any, you know, we played cards together. I mean, I got a chance to play cards on the plane with MJ. So, I mean, that's that's like a wow factor for me. So anything that MJ said or done, any kind of comments, he's very sarcastic. He'll get on you, you know, he'll poke you. And that's sort of things that he did with Kwame and a lot of and some of the other guys. I know Brendan Haywood, he would poke a little bit. But it was all really, you know, in fun, and I really respected him. So, you know, we didn't have, and I guess the respect was mutual because we didn't have, you know, any of those issues.
That's good. Yeah. A lot of people act like Jordan wasn't great during his Wizards stint. They talk about how he was terrible, but he still averaged 20.6 rebounds, 4 assists, 1.5 steals. He obviously wasn't the same player that we saw in Chicago, but would you agree that he was still pretty good, that people exaggerate that when they talk about, oh, he was washed up or whatever? I think, you know, he was still very effective. Would you agree?
I agree 1,000%. You know, he wasn't the MJ of the Chicago Bulls, but you know, that's time. And, you know, all good players and great players are going to go through that phase. But, man, you know, I watched him in practice. I watched him do shooting games. I watched his hand-eye coordination. I watched his fitness level. You know, those are all the behind-the-scenes things that people may not have gotten a chance to see, you know, during that, you know, that 48 minutes. But, you know, MJ was great until he was done,
yeah,
in my opinion.
No, I agree. And, you know, not many people can say they played with Michael Jordan and LeBron James. So I have to ask, what were the biggest similarities and what were the biggest differences between the two?
I think that the natural ability, but the attention to detail and the respect that they were not going to waste God-given talent. And that stands out to me the most is that they – you know, we all understood, you know, who they were from the outside looking in, but they had a deeper understanding of that they weren't going to let, you know, that their talent be wasted, and they were going to inspire other people. I mean, even though I played with Bron, he was younger, you know, we still had, you know, young guys coming into the team that looked up to Bron. So it was a situation where he, you know, he took advantage of that, and I think MJ took advantage of that as well. As to know that he would impact and inspire a lot of kids, you know, through a lot of different generations.
And then what were the biggest differences between MJ and LeBron?
I think the trash talk. And Brian would talk trash. I mean, he would make comments in a joking fashion. But M had this way of being really aggressive with the trash talk and really using body language and everything to really get his point across that he was, you know, seemed to be serious, may or may not have been, maybe just, again, trying to pull those things out of his teammates and out of his peers. But he just had this way about him of, you know, really understanding that he was, you know, the greatest.
When you would travel with LeBron, would he get a similar reaction as Michael Jordan when people would see him? Because I feel like social media has kind of changed things a lot in that regard, because back in the day, the thought of running into MJ was surreal. Whereas with social media, I think a lot of people feel like maybe they know LeBron and they see so much of his life and they can interact with him. You know, was it different, or were there still crazy reactions when they saw LeBron?
There were crazy reactions. Yeah, like you said, the social media aspect and his ability to, you know, to have more impact or to bring more people into, you know, into his space, whether that was with, you know, social media or commercials or, you know, what teams and organizations do nowadays as far as fan engagement, it was a little bit different, but, you know, not much.
Right, and he was still so young, too. That's, you know, when you were playing with MJ, he had a whole career and a whole legacy, and it was, I mean, he was on top of the world at that point. LeBron was 21 when you first joined the Cavaliers, so what was 21-year-old LeBron like?
He was, his ears were open. He was ready to listen. He was ready to incorporate ideas into his game. He had an idea of what his game wanted, you know, what he wanted his game to look like. But we had many conversations, you know, early morning, late night conversations about how great he wanted to be, you know, the sort of work that he was putting in place to be that great. And also just to his team and who he was surrounding himself with was also a conversation. And he felt that he could support, you know, the guys and support his team in a way that everyone around him could be successful. And I think that was his initial goal is for him and everyone around him to gain some success to help their families out.
For sure. You had a front row seat to kind of watch LeBron's development. he entered the league with such insane hype and expectations, but he somehow managed to live up to it. I think that's insane. People don't realize, you know, if he didn't become one of the greatest players of all time, then he would have been considered a failure because, I mean, he had so much hype. But what was it like watching him take that next step as a player when all eyes were on him and there was so much hype and scrutiny?
I love it, man. I love his progression and how he went about things. There was a certain point where he would not listen to anyone. And then I think he, you know, understood that he could take the good out of the things that he didn't want to listen to and start to make, you know, make good out of those things and put those things into his game. You know, the post-ups and taking the late game shots. And, you know, now he's shooting, you know, the three ball. So I think that these are all things that he thought about early on in his foundation of when he came into the league, of how he would expand his game and grow his game. And he's put that work in.
And I have to ask this, because you've played with both, because you've, you know, had a view of both. Now, after all said and done, you know, these days, who's your pick for greatest of all time? Who's the GOAT in your opinion?
MJ's the GOAT in my opinion. That's really a no-brainer for me. Really the inspiration behind wanting to push forward came from me watching MJ and how he worked and all of his videos and, you know, really instilling his work ethic in myself and, you know, trying to do the Breakfast Club. And, you know, he paved the way. So for me, it's an easy comment and an easy answer. LeBron, if we look at the Jordan emblem, you know, LeBron is just, you know, kind of hanging out there, you know, on the bottom of one of those Jordans. He's not far behind. But for me, it's always been MJ.
For sure. You played with Gilbert Arenas and Anton Jameson in Golden State before teaming up with them in Washington. With the Wizards, not only were you reuniting with those guys, but you also put up monster numbers. How much fun were those Wizards teams?
They were really fun. They were really fun. I think Eddie Jordan came in after MJ left, and he put in a new system, which was the Princeton system. They were running it in Sacramento as well. And that was the change. I mean, we understood that system. We bought into it. We watched, you know, hours of film to understand where teammates would be, where we could get people in the best position to be successful. And we really took ownership along with Eddie allowing us to take ownership in that offense and in that team. And we just kind of, you know, relied on our relationship that we had at another stop, and we were able to communicate and talk to each other. And, you know, we had some success there.
Looking back on your career, is there a specific season or a certain team that was the most fun for you?
Yeah, I mean, my last year in Washington, we had a lot of fun. We had different characters on that team, Gilbert and Antoine and Brendan Haywood and Jared Jeffries. Leitner was on that team before. So we had a good time hanging out. Jerry Stackhouse was on that team. So we had a good time hanging out as teammates and putting that, you know, all of those guys, you know, on one team that may have come from different places or, you know, were trying to make a name for themselves. And we kind of put our heads together and, you know, try to figure it out. So we were able to get, you know, some different accolades, you know, individually, but also we got the opportunity to, you know, play some playoff basketball before I left.
Yeah, and that season you were all defensive first team. You know, you led the league in steals per game, 2.9 steals. What was that? I mean, what were the keys for you to becoming a great defender? And if you were helping a player today that wanted to improve on defense, what kind of tips would you give them?
It's really about scouting. And you need to have a want to play defense, but it really depends on how much film you want to watch. If you know the other team's plays, you know, like the back of your hand. If you can call the other team's plays out, you know, once you see a set, then that just really puts you in the best position to be a good defender. I wasn't necessarily the strongest guy or even the quickest guy or jumped the highest, but being in position gave me, you know, an advantage, especially when you talk about steals. That's really, you know, understanding what the next play is before it happens and being in a position to get another possession for your team.
For sure. And I asked you about your favorite season. Which season was the worst or the most frustrating for you?
Probably my first season in Cleveland. After leaving Washington, I suffered a few hand injuries during my time in Washington. And that was something that that bothered me is that, obviously if you're not healthy, then you can't play and you can't produce. So, the best, the best thing you can do is actually be healthy enough to get out there on the floor. So when I got to Cleveland, that was really my mindset, is to be healthy. And I think I got hurt in the preseason. I didn't tell anybody until around December, January that I was actually hurt, but I pretty much shattered my middle finger on my right hand. So that season was kind of here we go again sort of deal, with being injured, not being able to play, not being able to, live up to the contract that I just signed on to. So that was a pretty tough season.
How tough is that? You mentioned, having the big contract. I've talked to guys like Rashard Lewis and, others about this and how frustrating it can be, because at the end of the day, you are judged by that. And, fans, they're always excited whenever they land a big free agent and whenever they see the headline that, my team signed this big free agent player, but then the contract always comes up and it almost looms over you. Does that, some players deal with it different ways. And, for some guys, it's not an issue. For some guys, it's really stressful. And I know at the end of the day, none of these guys, want to talk about this on the record because you don't want to seem like you're complaining about getting tens of millions of dollars, but it is a hard situation when everyone's criticizing you and bringing up the contract. What was that like for you?
It was tough because I obviously felt like I earned it. But for me, it was personal. It wasn't really any outside noise that would sway me, either way. It was just more of the thoughts that I had inside myself that I wanted to, take that next jump. I wanted to be the best player that I could be. So if you're injured, you can't continue to grow. You can't continue to learn. So that was, that was the tough part for me. But as far as the contract goes, I mean, fans and the outside people don't always understand the amount of hours and the amount of work that goes into being a professional basketball player, or being a professional in anything for that matter. So I completely know and believe that I put in enough hours. I was focused enough to earn the contract. Now it was internal for me to continue to grow as a player. Like I said, it's hard to do that when you get injured, and then you kind of take those steps back.
Yeah, when I talked about that with guys like Rashard or Nick Batum, they both pointed out, I didn't negotiate the contract. A GM offered it to me. My agent negotiated it. I just said, yes, I'm not going to turn down the money. So I think a lot of fans think, if you want to get mad at someone, get mad at the GM or get mad at injuries. Don't blame the player. That's how I kind of feel about it. And it is true. I mean, no one's going to say no to that kind of money. And you do, all of you guys, whether it was you or Rashard or Nick, you guys did earn it. You put up monster numbers and maybe things don't work out because of injuries. But at the end of the day, that's part of the game. And sometimes that kind of thing happens. But I think fans don't realize how difficult going through that is, with the injuries. I talked to Greg Oden and Penny Hardaway recently, and they both talked about how it was so difficult for them. Greg became depressed and even talked about on the podcast, having issues with substance abuse, drinking and things like that. And, Penny talked about how he was a completely different person. It took away his athleticism, his speed, his energy. When you're dealing with those kind of injuries and you want to go out there and play, how tough is it when you have those kind of setbacks and you can't live up to your full potential because of injuries?
It's tough because I think basketball is about rhythm. It's about flow. And anytime that you get off, then you break that flow. You break that cycle of just consistent days of being productive and building and growing upon the next day. So for me, it's like, man, when you're injured, you just really pull the plug on those consistent days. And for every player, that's playing any sport, the more consistent days you can rope together, the more consistent you'll be, because we're all learning and we're all, computing different things, on the fly. So the more time that you can get to apply those things that you learn or you see, I feel the better you'll be. And if you're injured, obviously you don't get that opportunity. While other guys are in their flow, in their mix, they're still going. So it's tough. And then you drop back into that, and you have to play catch up while trying to, get better at, or recover from an injury as well.
Yeah, and you see that over the offseason too, where if a guy's hurt during the summer and they can't work on their game, they're just focused on rehabbing and getting right, you know, that hurts the development process as well. So yeah, you definitely see that happen. You have four kids, and I know they were one of the reasons why you retired. You've talked about how you want to spend more time around them. How did fatherhood change you?
It gave me something to look forward to. It gave me more of, I guess, you know, more confidence that, you know, you had someone that's looking up to you for direction, for comfort, to make sure that they are heading in the right direction, because they're going to follow us. They're going to watch us in every move that we make. They're not able to critique us, but they're watching. So for me, it was like, you know, I gained more, I just gained more insight of who I wanted to be and how I wanted to conduct myself.
Since retiring, you also run the Larry Hughes Basketball Academy, which is the youth academy. What are some of the things that you do through the academy, and what's that process been like? You know, what's that endeavor been like?
Well, it's really getting a chance to inspire and impact young people with the thought process that they won't all make it to the NBA or the WNBA or play overseas or be paid to play a sport for that matter. So what we're doing is we're using basketball, you know, as an understanding of skill development, of building foundation, but also implementing character development, because we understand that, again, a lot of these young people will be dropped into our communities. They'll be dropped into our workforce. So we want to teach them how to communicate with each other, how to work as a team, how to fight through adversity, how to follow direction, how to find and create mentorships. So we're using basketball as a vehicle to create, you know, more social skills.
We've seen the NBA evolve a lot in recent years, a lot of three-point shooting, fast pace, things like that. When you're working with kids at the Larry Hughes Basketball Academy, do you see that affect the way kids are playing now? You know, are kids taking a lot of threes? Is it different from whenever you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely different. You know, I think as a kid, I would run out and, you know, chuck up a shot from half court, you know, as the first thing I did. I think that's pretty consistent.
We've all been
young
there.
People. Yeah, for young people. But for the most part, I think they're going to pick up the highest level of what their sport is. So the NBA is the highest level. So what they see those guys doing, they're going to come and they're going to do it. And it's up to us, you know, as an academy to, you know, give them the foundation to actually execute what they're seeing on TV. So that's a challenge. Sometimes they come in not prepared to execute what they see, you know, in an NBA game. But it's our job to try to teach them the proper footwork, the proper shooting technique, you know, and all those things that go along with what they're seeing on TV.
For sure. And what do you think of the way that the NBA is evolving? I mean, I'm sure it started happening a little bit toward the end of your career. You started noticing some of those changes. But what do you make of the evolution with, you know, a lot of three-point shooting? You have positionless basketball. Big men are now shooting shots and, you know, shooting threes and things like that. What do you make of that evolution?
I think the evolution is positive. I think that's, you know, all a part of growth. You know, I'm not one of those, you know, those older guys that say, you know, the game should be played like we played it, you know, in the late 90s and the early 2000s. You know, I'm not one of those guys. I think the game is in a good place. I think what we're trying to accomplish is being more efficient. And I think, you know, fundamentally, that sounds great. I think it's just an ongoing process on how we become more efficient. Is that more threes or is that more, you know, mid-range two-pointers? Well, if you're a great mid-range shooter, then that's probably your most efficient shot. So not being swayed by the fact that, you know, the number of threes that are taken in the game has escalated. So I think that's still an understanding of the game, but the evolution is, you know, very positive in my opinion.
And how much NBA basketball do you watch these days? And if you do watch, you know, are there certain players, certain young up and coming players that you like to watch?
There is. I mean, I watch my fair share. When I'm not spending time with the young people, I'm plopped in front of the TV watching, you know, any basketball game I can find. But mainly I'm watching Boston. Jason Tatum from St. Louis, my godson, my nephew is on Boston. So every time that they play, I'm pretty much tuned in. KD is out. But, you know, anytime KD is playing, I like to watch, you know, KD play. Damian Lillard, I'm really tuning in because he's on the West Coast. I'm checking him out when I can. There are a number of guys, man, and I just like their journey. I like the way that they kind of appeared on the scene. And Damian Lillard is one of those main guys that I like to watch today. It just his way that he goes about his business is 90s like.
Yeah, he's incredible. Amazing story too, coming from Weber State, was projected to be a late second round pick and then just blows up and goes sixth overall. I mean, great story. With Tatum, I know you guys are both from St. Louis, as you mentioned. When did you first get to know him and, see his game?
When he was born. I guess him and his dad are best friends. We're like brothers. So I've been knowing Jason since he was in Pampers.
That's awesome.
So I've saw his growth from, his little league football days, his little league baseball days to his basketball days. And his growth is I talked about this on our podcast. We do Believe in Wizards. Is that I've seen his growth the longest. So I actually give him the most improved because of the things that he's applied to his game, his attention to detail, his taking on the challenge, his coming back after a year of adversity to make an all-star team. So these are all the things that we talk about when we talk about progression. Jason is right there on the top of the list.
And I have to ask too, speaking of St. Louis, you were in a Nelly music video. I have to ask about this. the song is Dilemma. It's called Dilemma. It came out in 2002. You played Kelly Rowland's boyfriend, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
How did that come together and what was that experience like?
Being from St. Louis, Nelly is obviously from St. Louis as well. I was playing out in Golden State. I was really active in the entertainment space. I think I just did a few other commercials for, I think, a shoe brand or something that came up. And they asked me, hey, you want to do a cameo in the video? And I thought it would be a quick, scene where I would pop in, they would kind of pan the camera, see my face, and that would kind of be it. But when I got there, it was a little bit more to the script. So I was, I was the boyfriend in the video who was actually had his girlfriend taken by Nelly, which was a great experience for me. It, allowed me, an inside track on, how, videos are done, the kind of the hurry up and wait sort of thing that goes on within videos and the 8-hour days, for a 2.5-minute video. So it was a good experience for me.
That's awesome. And last thing for you, you mentioned your podcast, the Believe in Wizards podcast. We'll throw a link in the description too. What's it been like for you entering the podcast space and how are you enjoying it?
It's new for me. It's new for me. I'm pretty much a laid back type of person, pretty private, if you may say. But I made a New Year's resolution that I would get more active and get more into the space, because people do want to hear certain stories, and I have a ton of stories. People do want to hear certain insight from a guy that's a natural thinker. So I just wanted to apply that to into the podcast, and I love the Wizards, so. The opportunity came across my desk to talk about the Wizards and give some insight on, how the team is doing, but also speak about the league and speak about different things that, I understand to be true throughout the NBA. I just kind of said, okay, let's do it. And I recorded two podcasts so far. So we're just looking to do more and have some fun with it.
I love it. Like I said, we'll put a link in the description. Give me one of your craziest stories to give people a preview of what they can feel here on the podcast and what they can check out. Do you have a crazy story that you could throw out there right now?
Oh, man, this story is kind of been out there a little bit, but it's a story with Allen Iverson. Obviously, when I was drafted to Philadelphia, he was there. I had a name for himself, had a Reebok deal. The son of the city. Everybody loved Allen Iverson. And it was known that, he did it big, as far as with the cars and the Bentleys and the jewelry and all those things that go on with our culture today. He pretty much solidified that. So we talk about, when I came into the league, we had a lockout. So, we weren't necessarily getting NBA checks, but if you had any endorsements, obviously those things were still happening. So when I went to the bank, I went to the ATM machine and I put my card in and got a couple of dollars out, for the day. But I went to the bank with Allen Iverson one day and he didn't go to the ATM. He didn't necessarily go into the bank to talk to the teller. He actually went into the vault. He actually went into the vault, and this is how he took out his deposit. So this was really the first, the first interaction I had with someone with a lot of money. And when they gave Alan his money, it was still wrapped in plastic, and that was something completely different than what I've ever seen. And really, I've only seen it a couple of times after that. But that's one of my initial welcome to the NBA stories. It's been floating out there a little bit, but that's, one of the craziest things I saw up until that point.
That's incredible. Make sure you guys check out the podcast, Believe in Wizards. That's BLEAV, Believe in Wizards. We'll put a link in the description here so you guys can check that out. Larry, thank you so much for your time, man. I really appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much.
Oh, man, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Make sure you guys check out the podcast. Check out Larry on Twitter, The Real L Hughes. We'll also tag that in the description. And if you guys want to hear more episodes of the Hoopsite podcast, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere favorite podcasts are found. And until next time, thanks for listening.